Welcome to WFPL's Noise and Notes, WFPL's political podcast. I'm Philip Bailey. I'm joined here today by Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, WFPL's news director, Gabe Bullitt. Hi, boss.
Hey.
And Ann Marshall, staff writer at Leo Weekly. How are you guys doing?
Good. Pretty good.
And let's start with you. Now, yes. We hosted, or co-hosted,
yes,
the debate for the Louisville Metro Council District 1 race.
We did.
It involves Councilwoman Attica Scott, the incumbent, obviously, Rosa Macklin, a businesswoman in West Louisville, Janice Carter Miller, Ray Barker, Sr., and Stephen Colston. Now, how did you feel the debate went?
Let's see. I thought there were candid moments of honesty. I thought there was more brutal moments than I thought there would be. And I guess there was the Ray Barker moment of him deciding to jump in.
As I predicted,
it is absolutely true. And I thought you had actually predicted it correctly when just someone asked if he could come late. I thought, oh, I'll give you the victory on that. You predicted he'd want to get in, but then he showed up like you predicted.
And yeah, and to be all the way, full disclosure, you know, we had invited Mr. Mm-hmm. Barker to be a part of this debate at least 2 weeks in advance. At first he said, well, he didn't know if he could make it. And the week before the debate, he said he knew he couldn't make it. There was a scheduling conflict. Sorry. So we accepted that. And then after the story came out that he had mm-hmm. received contributions from anti-gay activist Dr. Frank Simon, we still didn't hear that he was going to come to the debate. Only like until after the debate started did he walk in
right. And
show up.
Right.
So I predicted that pretty
you
much.
Did. You yeah. did. You did. 100%.
Now, one thing that was surprising to me, though, was how Scott was being pummeled by her opponents for the King contributions, meaning contributions from
right. Council
President Jim King. And it made me think about the fact that during the Green removal trial, King was the villain. I mean, former Councilwoman Judy Green, who was removed from office due to ethics violations, she was the one who alleged that, and Councilman King denied this, but that King was intimidating her, that he really wanted to have control of the district. And it seemed that the candidates, the opponents, were all directing that towards Scott and ignoring the issue of Barker receiving funds from Dr. Simon.
I guess it's that, you know, I mean, they want that position and that's her weak spot. You know, that is something that...
She seemed totally unprepared for that, too.
I think so. And I think that, I mean, we were talking afterwards and I think that, you know, given her history, she's been an activist. She's been someone who's definitely tried to work with the community. I don't think that she's ever seen herself as someone who has inside government connections and who's wheeling and dealing in the back room. But, you know, I think that as we felt during that debate, there's some animosity as to the process of how she got selected for the seat. And so I think once that weak spot was brought to light, it was sort of an opportunity to pounce.
Well, before that, you saw almost universal agreement, it seemed, from everybody saying that there should have been a special election right away, which is would require what a change to state law. But they were not happy with the appointment process. And didn't all three other candidates say the appointment process was unfair?
They all thought it was unfair. Yeah. But this is the thing about and why I asked this question in these follow-ups. You know, the allegation that there was some sort of backroom deal was initially made by Councilwoman Mary Woolridge on the council floor right after Scott was elected mm-hmm. or appointed by the council. When you ask the candidates, well, who told you that? Where's the information coming from? How do you know what you know? No one wanted to answer. In fact, the candidates, one of them said, a little bird told me. I'm not sure if that was Tweety Bird, Fonghorn Leghorn, Chicken Boo, but no one wanted to answer that. And in these council races, you have that, this hearsay to where rumors can get started and you did this and you did that. And no one really wants to verify anything. It seemed that, though, still even through all that, Scott didn't have a sort of a direct answer to that, saying, here's the relationship I have with Councilman King. And by the way, he's not as bad as Frank Simon.
Right. And on its face, I mean, I guess one could follow that logic. But, you know, I guess for her opponents in this race, she's the one who got selected in their minds unfairly. And so here's this weak spot. And, you know, she's taking money from people outside the district. And that's not fair, because is she going to really have District 1 at the heart of all of her decisions? It was strange. And I think that it took her by surprise.
Now, with a few days left in the race, my prediction is pretty much, I think it's going to be Scott probably winning by a few hundred votes. I'm thinking either it's going to be Rosa Macklin and or Janice Carter Miller coming in second, and Barker will probably remain there third. And the reason I say that is if you're a Judy Green voter, if you voted for Judy Green 2 years ago, you're not voting for Ray Barker. He's the man who filed the complaint that ended up having her removed anyway. You're probably not that warm to Attica Scott either, because Councilwoman Scott has not warmed herself to Green or her constituents over the past 6 months. So those voters may be split in who they want to back. And then I think you'll have a situation where either Macklin or Carter Miller will come in fourth, and Colston will probably come in last.
Yeah, I thought Macklin was, you know, gave some honest answers. I thought that she was pretty ready for a lot of the questions that we posed.
She was she was the most fiery of all of them.
Absolutely.
I liked Carter Miller's answers because she surprised me that she actually was the only one who could answer how much does it cost to operate the Boys and Girls Club and keep it open. Well, there's some other council races, obviously, and one that people are sort of paying attention to because the incumbent got into a little bit of problems, a little bit of trouble this week, was Councilwoman Barbara Shanklin. Her grandson, Gary Bowler, he was arrested over Derby Day, and he has a pretty lengthy criminal history. Gabe, explain that a little bit. We've both done the stories. We've both been following council races for years. Everyone always, Councilman Green complained about Shanklin hiring her grandson during her controversy. Do you think this will have any impact on Shanklin as far as her election?
I don't know, because it seemed like while there were some conversations about her having her grandson on her staff, it didn't seem like that was really so much of a judgment on her as her ability as a lawmaker in the city. And the way that she presented it, I know we were talking about this when she fired her grandson, ultimately, with two of her sons at her side. She held a press conference to say she was firing her grandson and essentially painted the picture of, I was in a position to help. I tried to help. And he took advantage of that trust and took advantage of my kindness.
But she had known all along that he was had
right.
a criminal
and,
history.
And I think this exposes something that's pretty interesting in the council, even, because when we're talking about this in the newsroom, a lot of people in the newsroom weren't reporting at the time that ethics reform was going on, that multi-year process of all the talking and all the work
groups. It took 2 years for them to
groups.
Do that, by the
way. Exactly, talking about a new ethics rule. And it seems like people are just, in general, surprised to hear that a council member was able to hire her grandson to work in her office in general.
And that she won't be culpable for anything because he came in before.
The hire was made in 2008 and ethics reform wasn't in 2010.
Right.
Now, council Republicans obviously make the point that, hey, listen, who wanted to water down the ethics ordinance in the first place? It was council Democrats. And one reason they say that they wanted to water it down was Shanklin often made the argument of, how will this affect my grandson? Will he be grandfathered in? A lot of grands going on here. Will he be grandfathered into the situation? And so therefore, we shouldn't change the law to keep all relatives from being in these offices. Now, that's what Councilman Ken Fleming, the Republican, who is the original author of the ethics ordinance or the amendments to it, he wants to do. He wanted no relatives whatsoever. And somewhere I have to think, even though we didn't get a chance to talk to her, we tried to reach out to former Councilwoman Judy Green, somewhere she's laughing at all this. Because in two instances, she's saying, hey, look, I told you that the person who filed the complaint against me wanted the seat. What did Ray Barker do? He applied for the seat. Now he's running for it. Councilwoman Green also said, hey, look, the other people here who are hiring their family members, doing things that aren't always on the up and up. While technically it wasn't a violation because it was done before the ethics ordinance was changed, I have to think that Councilwoman Green feels somewhat vindication in this matter as well.
Do you want to get a Judy Green was right t-shirt?
I'm not going that far. Other council races that are kind of important, or at least people are watching, District 8, Councilman Tom Owen versus Brian Matthews and Mason Roberts. And then another one that's really interesting on the Republican side is John Akerson getting a challenger, Marilyn Parker. Now, I've looked through campaign finance reports, and what's interesting is that Akerson, if you look at who he's given money to, only Democrats. Democratic council members, Madonna Flood, I think he's given her some money, gave money to Steve Beshear. This is a former Kentucky Republican Party chair here in Jefferson County. And he's only giving money to Democrats, and obviously his own counterparts in the Republican Party on the council are all giving money to Marilyn Parker. And they've endorsed Marilyn Parker. I believe the majority of them did. Mm-hmm. Is John Akerson still a Republican? I mean, technically he is, but I mean, can he? I mean, you're only giving money to Democrats, and only Republicans are giving money to your opponent, your counterparts are.
Well, what's his relationship with the rest of his caucus? Is he sort of eating lunch alone, so to speak, or do they have—
Pretty much.
He's not caucusing with Democrats, though. He's still
goes to the caucus meetings. I mean, it's cordial on that front. But, I mean, I think as we reported earlier, Gabe, there is no relationship there. I mean, they pretty much have all of the eight remaining Republicans, I believe six of them came out for Parker, who is affiliated with the Tea Party, who by herself has made some pretty controversial statements about the president's birth certificate. I'm not sure besides being a birther what else she's gotten in trouble with. But, I mean, she's a pretty hard right-wing persona in the city, and yet all the council members on the Republican side are backing her.
Yeah, she had called the student assignment plan social engineering at one point at a school board meeting I'd covered when she was running for Congress. Yeah, very, very right wing, very much a part of the Tea Party. And it's interesting that these national issues would come into play because, as has been talked about and as was talked about during the mayor's race a couple years ago, there isn't really a Democratic way or Republican way to run a city necessarily. For, you know, you can't take something, you know, part of the DNC's platform and apply it necessarily in a lot of cases But
there
city
are some
governance.
Things in city government
there
that Republicans
are.
Favor more, the Democrats don't. Ethics
right.
reform, transparency, and issues like labor contract agreements, certainly council Democrats favor that. I mean, so there are some partisan issues that matter.
Yeah, you do see some conservatism, some liberalism on certain issues, but it seems like really the caucuses are, it's a party caucus, but it's also a group of colleagues, a group of potentially like-minded lawmakers who are going to get along with issues. So it would seem like for Akerson to lose that caucus support is might cause him some trouble in the council if he wins re-election even and create some awkwardness. It will be interesting to see what Marilyn Parker would do on the Metro Council, given that she has a lot of Tea Party views that may not necessarily apply to a city. I don't really think that we've seen many Tea Party mayors. I know across the river is a Jeffersonville. They have a mayor who has aligned himself on some issues with the Tea Party, and he has canceled some projects. He's called for some changes to the canal project and a few things like that. So, but aside from canceling spending, I don't see how really you could try to be a Tea Party lawmaker on a city level. The city is where the spending is immediately noticeable for your constituents. If you're cutting government, a lot of the government services the city provides, especially after these budget cuts, I don't know. It would be interesting to see a Tea Party approach to that. I mean, do you cut street cleanings further? Do you start privatizing city services? Either way, there has to be tax money collected and there has to be tax money spent on the city level. So looking at those core services, do you cut employee pensions? Do you cut employee benefits? What do you do necessarily if you're running a city as a Tea Party member?
I'm excited to see these council races this year. But there are some other elections going on. Kenny, Kentucky's 4th Congressional District, the Republican primary on that side, the crowded Republican primary, obviously, we all know in the reality there are three front runners. But in this race, some changes here. Senator Rand Paul finally, since we last talked, we were wondering if he was going to do this, he's finally come out for a candidate.
Yeah, he kind of slow-rolled into an endorsement, has filmed a TV ad for Thomas Massey, although I have yet to see that TV ad actually.
I've not seen it on TV.
On TV.
And is it actually a TV ad if it's only on YouTube?
Well, you know, the thing is if you look at Thomas Massey's website, he's trying to fundraise to put the TV ad on air, and the last I checked, probably 24 hours ago, there was only about $3,000, which is hardly enough to cover such a large district. I mean, you've got to play in the Northern Kentucky, Cincinnati market, here in the Louisville market, and you've got to play over in West Virginia for the Ashland market. $3,000 is not going to even get you like one ad on one of those markets. So there's a question of, does his campaign personally have enough money to, you know, make that ad work, to actually fully get that endorsement and make it work. But what Massey has in his favor is it seems two or three different super PACs are just pouring, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars into this race when it comes to airing TV ads for him and against his opponents. And that's really been the difference maker for him, kind of like Senator Rand Paul's own election in 2010. His campaign was funded enough, and Massey's is funded enough, but what is really putting him over the edge is some outside help.
Yeah. Now, I'm thinking here, I saw the KET debate, which, I mean, they had every candidate on there. And I always question when you have like when you have more than four candidates and you put all of them on the panel, it gets to be a bit of a, but that's snoring for those who don't know.
You're just saying that because you had four candidates in the debate you hosted.
Well, I mean, I set the standard. but, I mean, really, in this race in District 4, I mean, it's the past two or three weeks, it's nothing but Massey. I mean, Gary Moore hasn't been able to really jump ahead with any sort of, and not that endorsements mean anything at the end of the day, but I'm having a hard time distinguishing here who is the front runner, if at all. I mean, everyone says it's Massey and it's game over. I think Ann's colleague, Joe Sanka, Leo, made it clear that he thinks Rand Paul endorsed, game over. But I'm not totally convinced.
You know, what Moore has in favor of him is he's been Boone County Judge Executive. That's the biggest county up there for a long time, I mean, over a decade, probably going close to two decades. He's been involved in the get out the vote in those Northern Kentucky counties for that long, and that's not to be taken lightly. He also has endorsements from two groups that pulled in Northern Kentucky just as much as Senator Rand Paul might, and that's Right to Life endorsements. That is a very Right to Life evangelical area of the state. And they act on those Right to Life endorsements. Moore also has the most money himself. He's released a jobs plan that seems to be pretty comprehensive.
So why isn't he getting the sizzle?
Because, you know, there's something sexy about the Tea Party. I mean, as we saw about...
Sexy in political terms.
Exactly, as sexy as political terms can be. But, you know, Rand Paul, and there's just something about him, and Massey kind of, oddly enough, looks like him. They got the curly hair thing going on.
I thought about that.
They've got the same kind of...
their names start to run together.
Yeah, Rand Paul, Thomas Massey, and stuff like that. There's just certain things, and Massey has that big national Tea Party effect. And I think we can see this spilling over from, you know, what happened in Indiana with Richard Murdoch. I mean, people were ready to put the final nail in the coffin.
So if Massey wins here, I mean, that gives, I would think that would give Paul, politically speaking, a lot of momentum, not only going to his reelection, but, you know, people are already flirting with the idea of him running for president. Okay, we'll see. But him becoming more and more the king of Kentucky politics, obviously there are those of us in the political realm who cover politics who are wondering what is exactly the relationship between Senator Rand Paul and Senator Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate. I would think this gives Paul an immense amount of momentum in the sense that he's picked someone, he's endorsed them. He didn't endorse in the gubernatorial race.
Right.
Even though he could have with Phil Moffitt, but If he endorsed Massey and Massey wins, I think that gives him the upper hand politically.
Well, it definitely in the short term shows he can throw his weight a little bit around more when it comes to the Republican Party of Kentucky. It shows him that, you know, not only can I win my own races, you know, I can affect other people's races on a big scale. You know, does electing one congressman mean that you're on the fast track to the White House? I'm not sure that's the case, but at least here locally within the state and in one area, he can say, listen, my endorsement means something. Now, McConnell hasn't gotten involved in this congressional race.
McConnell hasn't made an endorsement since Trey Grayson.
Exactly. And I don't expect McConnell to do that anymore. I think that was a lesson learned, and he'll tell you that. But it allows Paul to kind of fill the void. If McConnell's out of the endorsement game and Rand Paul is getting in it, it kind of fills that void, and he can definitely throw some weight around.
I mean, do you see this as the start maybe of Rand Paul building up some of the power like Mitch McConnell has in the
state? I think so. I mean, Rand Paul has already tried to do it quietly. I mean, here in Kentucky. I mean, his
He endorses everyone outside of Kentucky.
Right. And
I mean, he was traveling the country, I mean, going around endorsing senators.
Right. And that may be the White House proposal. But here in Kentucky, I mean, he's tried to do it through some RPK reorganization that they're going through. This would be kind of a public, you know, coming out and saying, listen, you know, I know Senator McConnell is a great organizer. He's done a lot. You know, the building in Frankfort, RPK's building in Frankfort, is named the Mitch McConnell building.
I love this theory of yours.
So, but, you know, the thing is if McConnell, I mean, if Paul wins this, he can start saying, well, when Mitch...
Where's the Rand Paul building of...
Well, Mitch is going to go out the pasture sooner or later. So this kind of starts saying, well, can we have the Rand Paul annex of the Mitch McConnell building?
During the General Assembly, everyone was decrying the dysfunctionality, the gridlock. But I'm not hearing a whole lot about races as far as incumbents on both sides of the aisle being challenged.
You know, there are a few races, but some of the most important ones are where there's vacancies, especially in the state Senate. With the state House, it's kind of hard to find out what happens.
Why do we see people running? I mean, I heard everyone on both sides complaining about, oh, the 138 people in the state legislature, oh, they're so dysfunctional, they can't get along, they can't even do the basics like pass a budget or redraw the lines. Where are all the good people of Kentucky? See, this is what George Collins said. It's not the politicians who suck. It's the people who suck.
Right. The people are sitting on the sidelines because they didn't know what the lines were. I mean, this is the case where the dysfunction, and we were talking about this a little bit before we went on, about how the dysfunction actually helped the lawmakers this time around.
Dysfunction that they created.
Exactly. With the redistricting law, you know, the redistricting, then lawsuits, it gets thrown out. And then by the time they're halfway through the session, they're not going to redraw the lines. So, you know, it kind of helped because people didn't know if they were running the new lines or the old lines. You had people, very well-known people here in the Louisville area, Phil Moffitt, former congressional candidate Todd Lally, who filed for state house races in new districts. Those districts get thrown out, and those guys are left, you know, kind of wondering, well, what's going on, you know? And that confusion really, you know, good candidates don't want to be caught up in that. They just don't want to. So I think a lot of them just stayed on the sidelines and said, you know what, they'll have new maps, and in 2014 is just 2 years down the road, we'll run then. So it's really helped a lot of the incumbents either not have challenges or not have serious challenges.
Well, thank you all for joining us here on WFPL's political podcast, Noise and Notes. Ann Marshall,
Leah
Weekly, Gabe Bullard.
Hey.
And Kenny Colston, Kentucky Public Radio.
Thanks for having
me. Thanks for joining us. I'm Noise and Notes is produced by WFPL. For more information, visit WFPL.org.